start then, all right?
Okay.
Yep. Hello, I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We've got the pleasure to have online Bruce Davison. Now, Bruce, are you there, Bruce?
Yes, good evening, Hugo.
Oh, Bruce. Bruce, can you give a bit of a rundown of where you farm and what sort of farming you're doing?
Yeah, sure. We're in the southeast of New South Wales, Bega Valley, a place called Candalo. We've got 382-acre farm or 155 hectares, rolling hill country. We farm beef and are expanding a herd of goats, boar goats. Our farm historically has been heavily fertilised with superphosphate, and we're dealing with the residue of that, and we've taken a more biological approach, and the district is seriously infested with African lovegrass, and we've got that to contend with, and we've been through a major learning curve on managing that weed in particular, but also others, and having quite a deal of success. That probably sums it up, Hugo.
Good. Well, that's excellent, Bruce. One of the things you said, you've said in the past, that when you're buying that farm, you needed 800 acres to break even or to be somewhat viable.
Well, and, yes, 750.
How would you describe your viability in relation to that?
Well, we run at a profit. Each year now, we pay ourselves, Heidi and I pay ourselves an amount of money in advance that we, and we pay ourselves a small superannuation deposit, and the balance goes into managing the farm. So, yeah, we run a dough. For the size of the farm, on a percentile basis, probably quite a good profit because we have a very low cost of production. When we purchased in this area, we were told by DPI and Livestock Health and Pest Authority that we needed 750 acres to operate a viable beef farm in this region. And if you farm conventionally, I'd say they're absolutely spot on.
Bruce, so can you briefly describe how you farm and whether you're going ahead with the way you're farming, or are you actually going backwards a little bit?
Well, we're certainly not going backwards. In our first year, we struggled to keep 80 head, 40 cows and 40 calves. They didn't fare all that well. They got through okay, but not brilliantly. And now we typically have 160 to 170 head on, plus 70 goats, and they do very well, and we manage those quite comfortably. So we've gone ahead on carrying capacity. Our pasture is moving forward successionally, and the quantity of feed is annually increasing. We currently run at 120% of our notional carrying capacity. So, yeah, we're certainly going ahead. The first year we were running at around 50%.
Right. Now, you're not putting out any fertilizers like superphosphate, potassium or lime, are you?
Well, that's an interesting point.
Not like, not spreading them out by compost or by yourself?
No,
or
no. When we first started, I put out only worm juice, and I slashed, recycled nutrients through slashing, and sprayed out worm juice. About a year and a half ago, I started looking at compost teas, mainly to do a comparison. I'd shied away from thermal compost because of the energy required to produce it. I figured worms could do a similar thing with very low or almost no energy input. So I'm trialling compost tea for a comparison. So far, not a great deal of difference. The other thing I'm trialling, though, is from we've had some soil tests done. That's a very good way to see if you're going forward, to see if your nutrient availability is rising, which ours is. But we still have some elements that are still quite low. So what I'm doing now is, when I'm putting out my worm juice or compost teas, I'm putting out some of those elements just in very, very small quantities. I get them in dissolvable form so I can put them in the sprayer. And, you know, quantities of 1 to 2 kilograms a hectare. So very small quantities.
That's in total, is it?
That's the yield, yeah. And
no, what I mean is, like you did mention the few of the products you on the DVD that when we filmed you, is that like the total of all of those trace?
No, of each element. Uh-huh. Total of each element up to 2 kilograms a hectare. Some of them might only be quarter or half a kilogram a hectare. It's a little bit more than a homeopathic quantity, and as I've heard said, I think it gives the plant a buyer signal and stimulates them to seek more of that element which they would then exudate food for microbes that will harvest that element for them. And that seems to be working really well. The amount we've put on is nowhere near enough to get the result we're getting. We regularly have visitors now come in the last few months and exclaim at how dark green our farm is compared to the district. And the only thing different is the season is I'm putting these few small amounts of elements on.
Now, Bruce, just to give me an idea, I'm a little bit lost in your explanation, is that when you're putting out, say, copper or zinc, do you need to put out any of those two products?
I have done. It's not what I regularly do. I put out calcium.
Calcium. So what sort of quantity of calcium do you put out?
2 kilograms a hectare.
Right.
And I use hydrated lime because that will stay in suspension.
Yes.
The only thing I can't put into solution is sulfur. And I'm putting sulfur through licks that we're making for our stock and hopefully getting some on that way. I did as a trial, put a bit of sulfur on one paddock and spread it. Just as a trial, I don't think it did a lot more than the paddock beside it, but our sulfur is low, so some of the elements I get that I want to dissolve in my sprayer, I'll get them as sulfates, so there's a bit of sulfur in them.
Of course. Bruce, talking about spraying and the compost, we saw that compost heap you had there. What did that originally consist of, the heap itself, before you started putting your into it?
A pile of wood chips. It wasn't the type of wood chip you would see loading on a ship for export. That's pure wood. This was chipped up trees, so it was branches and leaves as well as timber. Mainly the prunings of trees, so probably 50% wood chip, 50% leaves and twigs.
Right. Now, when you started putting, can you describe the offal that you sort of were putting in, and how did you manage the offal so that it didn't attract vermin or didn't create something nasty?
Yeah, well, the small species abattoir and bega kills once a week. They kill chickens and ducks and rabbits predominantly, and we take the offal. We did a trial for 3 months. We're not doing it now. We've gone back to using fish, but we just did a trial because one of the people working there used to drive past our door, so it was very easy for him to drop it off on the way home, and they had a disposal problem. So each week I would layer it through, and we typically get about 100 litres of offal, half a wheelie bin full. So I'd layer it through, and that ran at about 75 degrees, that heap, and I kept it hot for 3 or 4 weeks to hopefully kill off any pathogens. I have used all of that compost now around our citrus orchard, and the trees responded very well to it.
So what size heap was it in terms of tonnage? Before we put the offal into it?
About 1.5 cubic metres.
Okay, and what about the maximum offal you could put into it?
Well, you need to aim at a carbon-nitrogen ratio of about 25 to 1, 25 to 30 carbon to 1 nitrogen. So you can. I work it out by temperature. If it gets too hot, I'm not putting enough carbon in it.
Now, why I'm asking you that question?
Because I don't know exactly what the nitrogen rate is for that offal. So, I just took a stab at it, and I maintained the temperature that I was aiming at, so it must have been reasonably close.
Now, the reason I'm asking that question is that if other farmers can get offal, which is stuff like that, how would they handle it? So I'm getting the idea that they actually can handle it by you layered it, but they could bury it in the middle of the heap, or?
Oh, well, layered gives the best results. I've got another heap going from animals. We had a goat that got bitten by a snake and died, and we had a cow, animal farm killed, and the offal and skin and lower legs and head, etc., we put in the compost, and a neighbour had a problem with a sheep that had died, so I went and got that, and all of those I just cut into, you know, the sheep, which I got fresh. I actually put it down for them. I just cut it into about 6 pieces and then layered it through a compost, and I used hay for that one, old hay that I got, ryegrass hay that was spoiled, and that heap's running at 74 degrees and has been for the last week. And that's about 1.5-2 cubic metres. And I'll keep it at that temperature for probably another week, and then I'll turn it for the first time. But at that temperature, the meat's cooked within 24 hours. The smell very quickly goes. So there's a bit of smell on the first day. After that, no problem. And it ends up very good compost.
It's quite clear that it is very good compost. We've got a question from one of our farming members, Roy McLean, and he asks, what are Salers, or how would you describe the Saler breed?
Right, yes. The Saler breed
comes...
yes, they come from France. They are the purest line of cattle in the world. They were unhybridized for 3,000 years. The French wouldn't let them out of the country until the very early 80s, when some French people in Canada managed to get some out, and from there they came to Australia in, I think, 1986. They're a European breed of cattle, large-framed. They're a dual-purpose animal. They use them in France for dairy and for beef. We got them because one of their primary traits is easy calving. They have the largest pelvic opening of all bovine. Now, they're a red animal. We started with a red Saler bull, which is on our website, and we put him over Angus, and because black is the dominant gene, the calves were, I think we ended up with 97% black calves. And because Angus are polled and Saler are horned, we got, and polled is the dominant gene, we got mainly non-horned calves. And we started that 10 years ago, and all of our herd now is composite. We were aiming at a composite herd rather than a purebred, because Saler are very big animals. A Saler cow at the Adelaide show, the mother of one of our purebred Saler, She tipped the scales at 1,000 kilos as a three-year-old, obviously in very good condition, but that's how big they'll get. And big animals need big diets. So we like the Angus, but the Solaire makes them more trouble-free for calving and also puts more muscle on them. The composite gives very good hybrid vigor, and our calves, when we sell them, are sought after because backgrounders grow them out and they know they perform exceptionally well. And it's because of this hybrid vigor of the composite. And the black, which is the color the market wants.
Now, you're having success selling them. You also sell the bulls and calves to cows and bulls to other people in other areas. When they breed with them, do they have do they have success in selling them as well? Because sometimes some areas, there's a particular, they favour particular animals like Angus or something like that. And
well,
so
today,
how do your customers find the sale of them?
To date, very favourable. We sell a small number of bulls. We only keep one or two bulls a year. We just pick the cream of the crop. And we sell all of our heifers joined. We don't sell weaner heifers. We grow them out. We sell them. We don't join them until they're 2 year old. And we're selling mature animals, and hence they sell well. Some of our customers have sold their, grown their steers out, and got a very good return on because they grow out very. If you've got good quality feed, they grow out very well. We've trialled growing some steers out. Typically, our pasture is not good enough, but we had a good year once, and we grew some calves out to 21 months, still milk tooth, and they were up to 625 kilos, averaged high 500s, in very good condition. So, they have that capacity to grow fast.
Good, good. With your goats on your property, how do you manage those? And do you see them there permanently, or when they get rid of the particular weeds, they will go off the property? What's the role of the goats on your property?
Their role is weed management and soil fertility. I don't know that we'll ever get rid of them. Initially, we're breeding up for weed control. I think we'll always maintain at least a small herd of them. They not only eat the weeds, but they have an amazing capacity to convert the weeds into pelletized fertilizer and spread it quite uniformly over the paddock. Goats are like walking. They walk around the paddock all day, and they're regularly defecating, and it's, you look at the paddock and it looks as though someone's gone out there by hand and spread it, whereas when you compare that to a cow, that'll defecate 10 to 12 times a day and range over a part of the paddock and then deposit all the manure in one spot. The goat spreads it around, and over time that has quite a big effect on the fertility of the whole paddock. And they typically graze the browsers, and they graze deep-rooted plants like blackberry and woody weeds, etc. So these are plants that are bringing nutrient up from deeper in the soil than grasses. And the goats that are converting that into a more plant-available form in their fertilizer, and they're spreading on the soil surface. So we've had them 2.5 years now, and there is an outstanding difference in the paddocks that they've been in to where they haven't.
That's excellent. I'm going to ask two questions about goats. One more question about goats. And how do you keep them in? Like, what sort of fencing do you require? What sort of fencing would you suggest
have
for them?
That's an interesting question.
How do you control them on your farm?
yeah. We started with a seven plain wire fence, four electric, four earth, three earth. And we set that up in the middle of the farm. We were told that's what's required. And if you've got a really strong energizer, then there is no issue. They won't go near it. However, because our energizer is not quite, it's only 16 joules, it's fine for the cattle. And as well as that, we also have a lot of tall growing grass, which as soon as you get a dew or a bit of rain shorts the fence out. We struggle to keep the current up. Some of the goats have worked out they can get through that fence. They come back every day. They'll go off into the next paddock. They won't go very far and come back. But clearly, we either need a stronger energizer or netting. And definitely, the boundary fence has to be netting, eight line wire netting.
But so far they haven't been a problem on a farm like that, not
none whatever.
Causing a no. So you're managing them quite well.
Oh, they're a treat to manage. Even when some of them are out into the next paddock, where they're not supposed to be, if one of us rides over there on the quad bike, they immediately race straight back into the paddock. not for fear that I'm going to tell them off. They come back because I might have something they want.
Yeah, like so your apples and carrots.
we trained them initially by taking over some veggies out of the garden or just some little tidbit when you go over. And if they think they're going to get something, they'll come straight back. And we've never had a problem with them not coming back in.
That's excellent.
And they're herd animals. They don't like to be separated from the main mob. So if half a dozen of them get out, they're not out long before they come back.
Well, that's good to know for farmers who want to introduce them on their properties for weed control. Now, you didn't mention, or you did start saying that that the goats are spreading the manure quite evenly around the paddock. Now, in your DVD, or with the DVD we produced, Heidi was talking about fertility, moving fertility up the hill. Can you sort of explain how that's working on your property and how valuable that is?
Yes, sure. But just before we go off the goats, one of the things we did when we got our first mob of goats was we visited them every day, took them something, built them a little shelter, let them know where home was, that then became their central camp spot. And whenever we went over to them, we went to that location, and that's where they always came to, even though they're only in that paddock. So now the rest of the herd, as they've come along and the goats have bred up, have followed that trait from the first ones that, if you like, we pampered. So, if you're getting goats, if you turn feral goats out into a paddock, then you've got a paddock full of feral goats. And chances are you'll have great difficulty keeping them in.
Were your animals, would you classify them as feral, or were yours somewhat trained?
Somewhat trained. They weren't pampered.
Oh, you mean the real feral ones that you catch up in the,
Well, some people do that. Some people do that and put them in the paddock and then say, well, these goats are no bloody good. We couldn't keep them in.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And if you buy them from a goat farm, where, domesticated goats, even then, if it's a large property, they can be quite feisty if they haven't been handled. And all it requires is that they get handled and they quieten down very quickly, provided you're giving them something they want, a little treat. And might only cost take you a bag of carrots or a bag of some sort of blended feed that they like to eat, and give them a little bit each evening, and in a very short space of time, they're there waiting for you.
Right. I'm going to interrupt you, Bruce, because we'll talk about going up. I'd also want to give an opportunity to anyone who's online. I noticed there's a few people online. What you've got to do is press *7 on your phone, that's this little star thing, and 7, and start talking. Don't wait for a gap, just start talking, because it's more important for us to hear you than us to keep talking. So if anyone's online at any given time when you feel like it, just press star 7 and let's see what you want to have a chat about or what question
okay,
you had asked
so
Bruce.
Are you speaking to me there or someone else?
No, I'm just letting the people on the line know
okay.
they can do that. So
they can cut in.
Yeah, they can sort of cut in.
Fine.
Bruce, can you explain what Heidi was saying about is it appropriate now to talk about to move the fertility up by the way
yes,
you're
it is.
Doing things?
Yep.
Because you made a very powerful statement in the DVD saying that over the last 150 years or whatever it's been, that we're moving our fertility down. It's the way we sort of manage our stock. So I'd like you to give us an example of what you're doing on your property or what farmers should do or just have a bit of a chat about that.
Okay. Our property is probably similar to many in that our water points are on the lowest point of the property. And in our case, we have two permanent creeks. No dams, and all of the paddocks, well, there were only four initially, and they all led to the creek, and the stock watered down in the creek. And when we first started fencing, we had to follow suit because setting up a trough water system was fairly expensive, and we've only just finished doing that. But what we observed was that the cattle were grazing upslope and walking down to the water, and then defecating either in the creek or on the banks of the creek because that's where they would ruminate and spend quite a lot of the day. So there was a continual movement of nutrient downslope. And sure, campsites in the tops of the ridges are another areas of high fertility because they'll camp there at night and defecate quite a lot up there. So the two deposit points for nutrient are the top of the ridges, the campsites, and down at the water point. Mid-slope misses out a lot on nutrient cycling from the animals. So what we've done is we've put in troughs which are gravity-fed from tanks that are set up on the highest point we could get them, and we've put the troughs as high up the landscape as we could get them. And then once the troughs were installed, we fenced off the water courses. And so the cattle now go up to the ridges to drink, and that's where they ruminate, and it's also where they camp. And so the nutrients being deposited upslope. So even that's grazed mid-slope or down in the bottom of the paddock, that's continually now being shifted upslope, which is a reversal from historically it was continually being shifted downslope. And once deposited on the top of the ridge, then gravity and rainfall can start that going back down the slope, and we can already start to see a difference along those upper slopes, a difference in soil fertility and pasture production. So I think we're trying to fix up 150 or 60 years of the reverse of that. But I think it'll happen fairly quickly, much, much faster than the time it took to go. I don't know how long that'll take, but we're adding to that by using our worm juice and compost tea and the little bit of mineral we put on, and that's hastening the process. So that's why we use the term run your farm up. Historically, they've been run down.
No, it's when we were talking to Charlie Maslin, he said the same thing, that he likes to see his troughs up in the hill using a solar pump to take the water up to the tanks or the troughs up the top of the hill, and rather than having the cattle or the sheep going down to the water points. So that's great. Bruce, we've got a question here from someone. The question reads, you work with a lot of farmers. Do you see similar problems amongst farmers wanting to change? Do you want me to read that out again?
Yeah, I'm just trying to get a gist of what's being said there.
Okay. You work with a lot of farmers.
Yep.
Do you see similar problems amongst farmers wanting to change? In other words, the problems that they want to change to the better.
Yeah, there is. Well, it's uniform, not just similar. Everyone has the same issue, and it's not just here, but you know, clearly the steeper the land, the quicker nutrient either leaches or is carried off land. And there's a growing groundswell of farmers here now getting involved in land care. Heidi and I are involved in land care and in the management of land care. And we've have sought quite a lot of funding to assist farmers in paddock subdivision and fencing off watercourses, etc., stock water. And farmers are now starting to see beneficial outcomes very quickly, as little as 2 years, and they can report that they can see change happening. And that information from those farmers is now filtering out to other farmers. So there is a groundswell. More and more people here now are realising that slashing is highly beneficial for recycling nutrient back into the soil. You know, old grasses that the stock won't eat, slash them rather than burn them, and you get a far better outcome. It costs more in the short term, but the long-term outcome is highly beneficial. So
when you say the long-term, what period of time, what's the difference in time? So if you burnt and, if you burnt, would you re-sow or just burn and do nothing?
Well, typically they'd burn and do nothing, just let it regrow, because the plant doesn't, plants don't die, just have the crown burnt off them, and then they'll regrow. Time, I would say 3 to 5 years, there's a discernible difference.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to slash for about 3 to 5 years to get the full benefit.
To really see without doing any scientific testing, just to observe a noticeable improvement, 3 to 5 years.
And is that economical for that duration of time to be slashing all that time?
Yes, it is. Yes,
the end of the 5 year period you're ahead.
Oh yeah. And I'm by economical, I'm comparing that to applying the cost of applying superphosphate.
Right.
You're ahead of the cost of doing that.
But you've done it much quicker than 5 years, though, haven't you?
Well, we've been doing it nearly 10. It took us 2 years to really notice that we were getting a good benefit. It didn't happen straight away, and it wasn't really until we went into drought after 2 years that then we could see our place didn't go into drought as quick as the district. And probably more importantly than that was when we got rain, we got very high rainfall infiltration. Virtually no water ran off, even heavy rain didn't run off. It all soaked into soil, so our property recovered very quickly from drought. 8 hours to turn green from being fairly parched. But when ours gets dry in a really big drought, it never actually goes brown. There's always a green tinge. The cattle always have green feed.
And that's because you've been slashing your worms.
Yeah, increasing organic matter. And also we've been spraying on worm juice, which stimulates soil biology. Our organic matter is rising, and you know, we've more than doubled the organic matter in our soil to date.
That's tremendous. Now, let's have a bit of a chat about the way you make your liquid. How would you describe your liquid? What category is it? Is it a compost tea? Or is it a vermicompost tea? Or?
The worm juice is the main one I make.
Which is just
the leachate out of the worm farm.
Yes.
It's only in the last couple of years that I've started making compost teas. So most of the liquid we put on is still worm juice, just that drains out of the worm farm. And I put it on diluted, approximately 10 to 1. 10 water, 1 worm juice. Sometimes I'll put various things in with that, a little bit of molasses, I always put in now fish hydrolysate that I make, which is basically just fish decomposed in water. That's a really good multi-mineral fertilizer. Really lifts the bricks in the plants. And I make a compost tea now. I've started making thermal compost, and I brew up a compost tea. I've tried making tea from worm juice, and I've tried making tea from worm castings, but because they're typically mainly anaerobic substances, the thermal compost will brew up far more organisms than the worm castings will. You get significantly more fungi in thermal compost than you will get out of worm castings, and I've tried feeding large amounts of or increased amounts of hay, loosened hay, etc., to them to get them, try and stimulate fungi, but it still is not comparable to thermal compost. So if I want to brew that's going to be high in fungi, I use compost, and it's much, much easier to do.
Do you blend thermal compost with vermicompost, the two together, or you just stick to the thermal compost when your piece?
I trialed blending. Did all sorts of trials. But just the thermal compost ends up the best for making a compost tea.
We couldn't help but notice, naturally, that your equipment was pretty rudimentary. You didn't see stainless steel vats and that sort of thing.
No.
So, but you've got the advantage of looking under the microscope to make sure you don't get rogue bacteria in it. So would you like to have a bit of a chat about that to other members?
Well, yeah, I clean the brewer and my sprayer after every use. When I take the compost tea out, if I'm going over the farm to spray it away from here, I'll put some in the spray tank, and the rest I'll put in small drums to take over with me. But I always immediately clean out the brewer, because it'll get a build-up of almost black, soily slime around the top of it from the compost. I clean all that straight away, flush out the air hoses, air pipes, etc. I've never really had a problem with any so-called bad organism.
Hygiene is
very important. Yes, clean it out straight away.
Yep.
You don't want anaerobes.
I got the idea that because you had such basic equipment that your hygiene, you might have developed a new technique in hygiene.
Yeah. The strongest solvent known to man is water, so I just use pressure water to clean it, and a scrubbing brush where necessary, and the spray tank, I just put the pressure hose in it and just give it a spray out and run it out, leaving it clean. And sometimes when I get back at the middle of the night, I don't do that. And it might be that on one occasion it was the last time I sprayed for about a month, and when I had a look inside, I had a good growth of algae in the last little bit in the bottom, and I just pressure cleaned it out, and it was fine. No problems at all.
Bruce, you run courses, and you are going to be running a course in May. Can you describe the sort of courses you have run in the past, or probably more importantly, what sort of courses you're likely to be running in the future? We might describe your course that you're going to run in May.
Yeah, the one on the 5th of May is a one-day workshop. It is a compressed version of the Soil Food Web's three-day compost tea and microscope course. I've compressed it down to one day because typically farmers like to come and do a workshop for a day and go home and better do something. They don't want to. They shy away from doing two or three days because they're time poor.
Yeah.
excuse me. So this is a workshop on making compost, making compost tea, applying compost tea. We look at worm farms, worm leachate, and applying that, and we look at, and we deal with microscope use. I've got a microscope with a camera that I hook up onto the laptop and onto the data projector, so we can, some people bring microscopes if they've got them. And then we look at soil, go and dig a hole in the paddock and look at soil structure, soil profile. I always include that because that's the best monitor of what, if you haven't got a microscope, if you want to know if you're, if what you're doing is having a good effect on your soil, you need to dig a hole and have a look and look at the A1 horizon and look at the structure, and you need to be able to measure the A1 horizon and see that you're actually growing a deeper horizon.
So you, this is what you're going to be covering on this one day
course. I do this on this one day course, yes. And then we take a soil sample and do a microbe extract and have a look and see what's in the soil. And that pretty much sums up the day. It's a very full day.
Sounds tremendous.
A busy day.
Yep. And what sort of farmer would you expect, or what sort of farmer should enrol to or get in touch with you? And how do they get in touch with you?
Email. At the bottom of the flyer, there's a registration email address, which is mine.
Yep. We'll be circulating that. We have already circulated that to our members.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, what sort of farmer would benefit from coming to you? Does he have to have some experience?
Oh, anyone.
With the microscope?
No. That's why we do the soil inspection, because that, if you're making thermal compost, there's only one way to know that it's as good as it can possibly be, and that is with a microscope. However, if you go through the heat processes right, and it smells reasonably good at the end of the composting process, then there's a very, very high probability that it's quite good compost. And if you go through the tea brewing process and you don't have a microscope, and you do it for the appropriate amount of time with the appropriate amount of oxygen and food source for the tea brewing, you can brew up some quite good tea without having a microscope. But again, the only way to know that it's exactly right is with a microscope, but you can get good outcomes without it. And the way to monitor whether or not you're getting a good outcome is to monitor the A1 horizon of your topsoil.
So if a farmer's a bit shy, if a farmer's a bit, thank you for saying that, about the topsoil, soil structure, to monitor that way. But if a farmer's a bit shy about the possibility of buying a microscope or using a microscope, not that they should be, because quite a few farmers do look at worm eggs, mm-hmm. and their feces and things like that. So would they still benefit?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. There's lots of benefits other than, I don't spend a lot of time on the microscope because not many people have them. But a lot of people know how to make compost or run a worm farm.
Yep.
And the benefits from those can come without having to have a microscope. The microscope is a tool to confirm what you're doing, and it's also quite a bit of fun to know that you're doing it right. So, but it's not essential.
Right. So any farmer any sort of farmer could come to your course, irrespective whether cropping, grazing, or horticulture, or
yep, or even if it's someone living in town who's a home gardener growing their own food.
Fantastic.
We always tell everyone when you're making compost or worm castings or worm juice or whatever it is that you're doing to stimulate soil biology and improve the health of the soil, the first place to apply it is on your own food source, on your own home garden, because you can't make good decisions if you're not eating good food. So you've got to feed yourself well first.
Now, seeing you talking about good food, you and Heidi have developed a garden which looks very similar to the Japanese guy, Masubu.
Oh, yes, the One Straw Revolution guy.
One Straw. And there's a degree of similarity with that. So could you describe, well, people have seen your garden, but give it a brief description, and how did you go about setting it up, and what are the steps to set it up?
Okay, well, this was a ridge of African lovegrass, a bit stony. The soil is not suitable for digging because it's too rocky, but we've never dug gardens anyway. We've always had a no-dig garden. What Heidi did was she just put a sheet. She sheet composted it, if you like, with a thick layer of mulch. Left it for about 6 months, and everything under that, of course, died because it couldn't photosynthesize, no sunlight. And then when it came time to planting the fruit trees and then other veggies, etc., just made a hole in the mulch and put the tree in, which obviously needed a hole, but veggies, just scratch the ground and put a seed in or a seedling in. And since then, very few vegetables are ever bought. They're all self-perpetuating. Each year, Heidi always leaves a number of them to go to seed. And then there's always a year-round supply of seedlings to dig up and transplant and trade with other people for their seedlings, etc. So it's a self-perpetuating food. Well, we call it a food forest. It supplies a large portion of our food along with our own meat. We often will sit down to a meal, and everything except the pepper and salts come from this farm.
Excellent. Now, that's our aim. Is it easier, or is it running the garden that way rather than in set beds and a little paths between the set beds?
I think it's much easier. We go through occasionally and do a bit of weeding, or you can just stand on the weed and put another layer of mulch on it, and it just suffocates, and it becomes part of the mulch. Not just weed, but even the vegetables, if there's too many of them that come up, you can mulch them if they don't get to the goats. It's a very, very simple way to grow a garden. It doesn't look neat and tidy like a straight lines of beds, etc. That always looks neat and tidy, and people seem to impress people. But we can walk out into the garden year round and come back with a basket of food to eat.
I was really impressed with that, to the point that we are starting our own garden. Well, our former garden was what the paths, etc. Well, what we're going to do, what you're doing, because we're so impressed with it. Now, Bruce,
I think another point about that, Hugo, is that by having an informal planting like that, the species are very mixed up, so there's lots and lots of diversity. There's no straight row of any one species. They're all over the place, and so everything's mixed up. It's very diverse, and that in itself generates health within the garden environment.
I suppose you have beneficial insects to counteract the problem ones, I guess.
Oh yeah, and they ebb and flow. Sometimes you might get a bunch of aphids coming we have grow broccoli that might grow for a long time, and then when it starts to senesce, you might get a few aphids coming, and in no time there'll be a bunch of ladybugs who'll come along and say, well, there's a takeaway shop, we'll go and take up camp there, and they control it. So you let nature take its course. We never beat ourselves up over anything eating more than we think it should, except birds. We have to net some of the birds to get our share of fruit.
Fair enough.
Hello, you,
Bruce. Yes, please. Who's on the line?
Yeah, Roy McLean here.
Hi, Roy, please. Have
G'day,
a chat.
Roy.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Roy.
Yeah. Bruce, Just want you to describe the reasons why you use both worm juice and compost tea. What's the purpose of each one?
Right. Well, as I said earlier, we used the worm juice because it was so low energy to make. The reason I'm doing compost and compost tea now is simply to do a comparison. If I can come up with a way to do it better, then I'll, and it's economic to do it, then I'll do it. And I, you know, people like Elaine Ingham has sung the praises of compost for some time, and so I thought, well, I'll give it a go and see how good it is. You know, I've been doing it for a year and a half, I think. Something like that with compost or compost tea. So far, there's not an outstanding difference. There's not an immediate change. I'm going to continue on for another year or two with compost tea and see what the long-term difference is. I've got some trial paddocks side by side with worm juice to see what the outcome is. So that's the reason why I'm doing it.
Ah, right, right. So what sort of materials do you use for your compost, Bruce?
I use grass, legumes, clovers.
I just sort of mull a piece out of the paddock and just bring it in, do you?
Yeah, well, yeah, yep, that's all. Or and old veggies around the paddock around the garden, and if there's a mob of thistles somewhere, thistles are pretty good. And for my preferred nitrogen source is fish. I go down, because I live near the coast, I go down to Eden, which is 45 minutes away, and I can pick up half a ton of fish offal and, you know, put that with a large quantity of other carbon materials and get a really good compost heap going and get a good outcome, because the fish has very high nutrient.
Right. So you use some woody material like tree prunings or tree
not a lot of
them, do you?
I do a bit of wood chip. We don't do much tree pruning, so I don't have much of that sort of stuff. Love grass is pretty good. It's very fibrous, and just, you know, whatever grass is. Kaikuyu is good. A lot of fibre in that, and the heat stops it growing.
Right. So do you turn your compost at all?
Yep.
Do you? Or most
of you? Oh yeah, yeah. I turn it regularly. Once I get it hot, I've got a couple of heaps going now that I've got animals in. One were animals, one fish. We collected the waste a week ago from the Maroombula Food Festival. We take home the compostable waste from that, and because it was nearly all obviously they served good food, because there wasn't much food, it was all paper plates and I just put a lot of I got a load of spoiled ryegrass hay and some fish, put some fish with it, that and the animal heap. I'll leave them go for a week or 10 days before I turn them the first time to make sure they're thoroughly cooked.
Right.
And then I'll turn them probably two or three times a week.
Right. So you got a compost turner? You got a compost turner, or just use a
These are small heaps, just 1.5-2 cubic metres, I just do it with a fork, garden fork.
Oh, I see, right. Ordinary garden fork.
Yeah, just a garden fork, yeah.
Oh,
you can buy compost forks that are bigger, but it takes me 2 cubic metre heap, it takes me 10 minutes to turn it and
that's not long.
Inspect it and, you know, sprinkle a bit of water on it every second or third turn if I have to, etc. And I monitor its temperature, so I know, you know, if it starts dropping, it's probably run out of moisture or air and needs a turn.
So what's the ideal temperature for the compost?
About 65.
Right, so if it's above 70, you sort of got to start cooling it down, have you?
Well, yeah. If I've got animal residue in there. I quite like it to go to about 74, 75 for quite a few days, and you know, just to thoroughly cook it and get rid of any pathogens. But typically, your compost heap, once you go past 70 degrees, it'll fairly quickly run out of oxygen, because you know, there's so many organisms in the compost that they're breeding up so fast, they're consuming the oxygen. And once you get past 70, then you'll start breeding anaerobes in the compost because of the reduced oxygen. And there's a risk then that anaerobes produce alcohol as a byproduct. And alcohol has a flash point of 70 degrees. So you've got a risk of a fire.
Oh, right.
Yeah. In fact, the fire down at East Gippsland, just after Christmas, the one, I'm trying to think of the name of the place now, it was an extensive bush, started as a grass fire, went through a lot of properties, took out quite a few houses, that started in a compost heap.
No, did it?
There is, so, you know, not good for it to go past, especially in midsummer. If you're composting, don't let it go past 70.
Right. So how long do you actually compost the material for before you start using it?
Well, I'll keep turning it until it starts to cool down. If it's got enough nitrogen and carbon in it that hasn't broken down to keep hot, then I'll just keep turning it. Some of the heaps I'll turn 10 or 12 times over a couple of months. 2 to 3 months, and then as soon as it starts cooling and gets below 40 degrees, then I'll start using it.
Right.
Bruce, don't go away, Roy. Bruce, when you produce this 1.5 tons of compost, power compost,
cubic
how many
meters.
Hectares can that be spread over when you make tea?
Good point. Well, I start with a heap of about 1.5 cubic meters, not tons, cubic meters. And when I'm finished composting, that'll be typically probably less than half that size. If you're brewing compost tea, 4 liters of compost brews 1,000 liters of tea. So Elaine Ingham recommends the first application of compost tea should be 200 litres a hectare, and then after that should be 40 litres a hectare. So you can work out, you know, if you've got a 1,000 litre brewer, then you know, the first brew is going to do 5 hectares. And then you know, once you cut it back to 40, then you've got 5 times that much. The second brewer would do 25 hectares with a 1,000 litre brewer. And that takes 4 litres of compost. So if you got if you had a cubic metre of compost that's 1,000 litres, you can easily work out that it's going to cover a very large area. You don't need a lot of compost, even though there's quite a lot of energy to make thermal compost. If you're brewing tea out of it, you don't need a lot of compost to cover a large area. So I can easily make compost by hand without buying expensive machinery to do my 155-hectare farm. It doesn't take a lot of effort at all.
Roy, back to you. Anything
right.
else you want to have a chat about, Roy?
About the goats. Do you have any trouble with worms or parasites with your goats?
Yep.
Do you have to...
Yeah, we don't. At this stage, we've still only got 3 paddocks fenced for goats. If goats really benefit from rotational grazing and shifting regularly onto fresh ground, so we do get a bit of a problem with parasites. And unlike cattle, goats will fall in a heap in one day. They seem to, you know, if they get a bit of barber's pole or something, they can look as good as gold one day, or an animal can, and the next day you think it's about to die. They'll go down very quickly, and we drench them with Epramec. We haven't got to the stage of using more organic products yet, because we've just got a bit too much on. Earlier on, we drenched our cattle with... organic apple cider vinegar and seaweed, and that worked really well. And I imagine it would probably work well with goats.
I'll tell you another thing that probably would work reasonably well too, Bruce, is you ever tried diatomaceous earth with something like kelp? Just mix it in and just use it as a lick.
Yeah, diatomaceous earth, yeah. Well, I've started making a lick for them with powdered seaweed and salt, and otherwise I'll eat the whole lot because they like it. And I put a bit of added sulfur in it for external parasites. And then I just mix that up with a bit of, again, because we're by the coast, I just get seawater. I mix it up. I used to use just fresh water, but I mix it with seawater now. Into a very thick, well, I was going to say paste, but thicker than a paste. So just make it wet or moist so it's no longer a powder and they can lick it. And I've been putting that out for a few months now, and I've noticed that a big improvement in their health.
Right. Yeah, I've used this diatomaceous earth of kelp with sheep and cattle here for 2-3 years now, and I've noticed a big improvement in them now.
Right.
The cattle I haven't drenched for years now, and
yep.
Sheep I'm not drenching them now. Not even with sort of organic drenches.
How do you give it to them?
I just mix it up with kelp meal. It's in powder.
Yep.
And just mix it up by hand in a little cut open 20-litre drum.
Yes.
And just put some kelp in there and put some diatomaceous earth on top and just mix it in by hand.
Yep.
And they'll just come and lick it.
As a powder?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, oh, good.
Yeah.
What proportions?
Oh, well, you've probably got to start with somewhere like about 70% kelp and about 30%.
Yep.
Okay. Diatomaceous for a start, until you get them used to it. And just gradually reduce the kelp and increase the diatomaceous. You can get up to about 50-50 after a while.
Righto. Okay, oh, that's worth a try.
I haven't tried it myself, but some reckon they just give the diatomaceous herb neat to them, and they still go for it.
Yep.
I haven't tried it myself yet.
I should try that, because there's a local person that sells that, local farm supply place. So thank you for that. Another experiment.
Bruce, I want to ask you a question on your things you've done for your owls. For your rabbit control, I think that's. Can you see that being duplicated on other farms?
A lot of people have, not a lot. Many people have expressed an interest and taken photos and notes of them, and I really don't know, Hugo.
It certainly beats putting out poisonous carrots and things like that, I think.
Oh, it sure does, yeah. I just noticed that when I used to go spotlighting rabbits at night, I'd regularly come across an owl trying to stand on top of a steel fence post, not doing well, and especially seeing the top wire that its feet were right beside was electric, and I thought because there's very few trees on our farm, although fast changing, we're getting quite a few trees now, but so we thought, why not give them something to stand on, and. Well, I can't say positively that it's worked, but our rabbit population is not exploding. It's certainly, I would say, decreasing. So, again, I can't say that it's positively working, but it's a nice, gives us a nice feeling that the owls have got somewhere to stand, and there's a good possibility. And wedge tails, you also use the perches. Yeah, so they'll stand on the perch during the day and await a rabbit.
Good. Roy, we are going to close off now. We try to keep these calls to 1 hour or thereabouts.
Yep.
So thank you very much for Roy for being on the line and for the other, and for asking questions in particular, Roy, and for other people who are on the line. So I'd just like to thank all the farmers who are going to be listening to this to listen to this sort of thing and listening to you, Bruce. So, Bruce, what would you like to say, or what could you what messages you got for farmers, or what would you like to say on a departure basis?
Yeah, well, if you continually do things that improve the health and structure of your soil, over time, it will reward you. When we started here, we could see no sense in applying poison to the land. We figured if we needed to increase life on the land, we couldn't see the sense in applying poison. So we applied products that stimulated life, and that's now rewarding us.
Bruce, I don't see you as a sort of a farm who's stressed. Would that be a fair statement to say?
That'd be a fairly good statement, yes.
meaning you're not running your farm with a lot of stress level.
No. I try to keep that to a bare minimum. I can't see the point in that. We're not trying to become the most successful farmers about. We're just trying to have a farm that is financially viable and ecologically sound, and it can be handed over to the next managers in better condition than when we found it, and it gives us a very good way of life.
I do think the fact that you're running courses for other farmers and sharing your knowledge, with the knowledge you've got and your actual practical experiences, I think that's great that any farmer can do that, and it's great that you're doing it, Bruce.
We find it a very enjoyable thing to do. It's great fun, and when you're with a group of farmers, I might be the teacher delivering the course, but I always learn something. And the more I do it, the more I learn, which is great.
Great. All right, Bruce, on this basis, thank you very, very much for coming on the line, and thank Heidi too. I know she'd be somewhat listening. And thank you very, very much, Bruce.
Okay. Thank you, Hugo.
Thank you, Bruce. Yeah,
thank you, Helen. Yep. Mm. Thank you. Good luck. Thanks for the tip.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right,
see you, Hugo.
Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.